Are you seated, please?
Next case on our calendar is 96-17-92, State of Ohio versus Robert Bertram. Mr. Rakoff.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices, Mr. Harrison. Hey, please support. I'm Steve Rakoff, Assistant Prosecutor's Attorney for Hamilton County. I'm here today to represent the state in the matter of State of Ohio versus Robert Bertram. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time on the clock there.
Mr. Rakoff, we reverse this case, send it back to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals affirms. Your prosecution over.
That's it, Judge. Court of Appeals decides that our evidence...
Is that based on the amended rule or the original rule?
That's based on the amended rule.
Didn't the original rule apply to this case?
No, it did not.
No, I guess it was amended in 95.
Yes, Judge. The amendment is the first of all, 95 in this case.
So you're prepared to stand on your certification that if this evidence doesn't come in, your prosecution is finished.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Very simple. I'm going to point out in this case before I discuss why the prosecutor's 12-day certification is not subject to review and also why the appellate court lacks the jurisdiction or the authority to review that certification. Just to explain briefly why this case is moving forward. He first was stopped after speeding, failed to control his driving test, and was arrested on suspicion of DUI. He refused to take a breathalyzer test, and based on that refusal, he was charged with DUI, and his license was suspended under the administrative license suspension provision. Prior to trial, the defendants filed a motion to suppress the evidence of refusal. And their grounds for that suppression was that the administrative license suspension was improper, or the provisions of the ALS suspension were improperly read to Mr. Bertram, and therefore was not an informed decision. The trial court upheld that motion to suppress and stated in appeal not only was that clearly erroneous as a matter of law, but it effectively destroyed the state's case at that point. And we believe that once the certification is made by the prosecutor in that case, that it's not subject to review, because it's at the time of filing the notice of appeal, along with the 12-day certification, that the appellate court accepts jurisdiction. It's a preliminary jurisdictional matter.
The Court of Appeals did not have in front of it all of the files of the prosecutor, correct? There's not really a record made on what all the other evidence was beyond the suppression, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. At the time of trial, the only documents before the appellate court at that time are the notice of appeal and the prosecutor's certification. That's it.
So, what are they basing their decision? They're having the outside directors to make a decision that you could still prosecute this case without this, aren't they? Because they don't have that on the record for them to make a judgment.
That's exactly our point, Judge. In order for them to reverse, they would have to look outside the record. However, in this case, what the First District Court did was they waited until the case was brief. And in fact, it wasn't until oral arguments that the issue was truly raised before the court. It had, in fact, been raised by the defendants in their brief in response to the state's brief. And a third assignment of errors, which the state hasn't even talked about, claiming that our certification was improper. The court didn't rule on that particular assignment of error until oral arguments. And it was at that time that said, well, this is really tantamount to a motion to dismiss this appeal. At that time, both parties went back. We had to actually file a motion to dismiss, and the state filed a response. And then the court issued their decision to dismiss the state's appeal. It never got to the merits of why the state was appealing this issue.
Well, in the Court of Appeals opinion, the opinion, as you know, cites a number of factors that the evidentiary factors that are remaining for the prosecution to use, the officer's skill and his smelling the breath and speech stuttered. Where did that come from?
That came from...
That's not outside the record, is it?
That's outside the record, but those issues may have been raised had the motion suppressed, but again, that record isn't used at trial to determine the issues.
Well, but if we get beyond, if we say the Court of Appeals has the authority, and that's, of course, that's is the issue, to review the prosecutor's representation under 12J, can't the Court of Appeals use that to determine whether there's evidence, other evidence, upon which the prosecution could proceed? Is your contention they could not? Right?
No, because the 12J certification, at the time it's made, there's no record before the court. That certification must be accepted as true and must be taken as a point of jurisdiction. At that point that it's filed and it is taken in by the appellate court, jurisdiction is established. At that point, then we move forward with the issues on appeal. The issues that the court should review at that time are the legal issues that were suppressed, or the factual issues, whatever the issues that were suppressed in trial, prior to trial. So in this case, what we're saying is that once the motion to suppress is granted, the state has an absolute right to appeal as a matter of law under 2945.67, so long as the state complies with Criminal Rule 12J. This court has held in numerous decisions, Malinowski, Davison, French, Fraternal Order of Eagles, and going as far back as the early 1980s, State versus Buckingham, before that once there is a motion to suppress that is granted, the state has an absolute right to appeal. And the 12-day certification must accompany that. The only reason that we have the 12-day certification is to prevent prosecutorial abuse and to harmonize the final order requirement, because normally you would be able to appeal until, as you all are well aware, until the end of the case. Well, if you're allowed to proceed, and we come to the end of the case, you can't then go back and try the case again with the evidence. Once suppressed, you have double jeopardy. So that's why it's critical that we're allowed to have the issue reviewed on appeal prior to going forward.
To hold otherwise appears to be very speculative. It would be the Court of Appeals opinion versus the prosecutor's opinion.
Absolutely, and I believe Your Honor addressed a similar issue in the Fraternal Order of Eagles case, where in that opinion, it stated that the trial court in that case, if you all remember, the trial court allowed the case to go forward, even though the prosecutor had certified the issue for appeal. In that case, the prosecutor could go forward, the case was dismissed. And Your Honor stated in the opinion that the trial court not review the sufficiency of the state's evidence at that time. We're saying that applies to the Court of Appeals as well. It cannot review the sufficiency of the state's evidence. In fact, even though there is other evidence in the record that the state could possibly proceed on, it's for the prosecutor to make the determination as to how that case is going to be tried and how the evidence that's suppressed would fit into the overall scheme of the trial plan, order of evidence, and what the magnitude is of that evidence or expression, not for the Court of Appeals and those judges to determine how the state should try the case. And the other reason that the 12-day certification is there is that it provides the prosecutor with guidelines to follow to ensure you prior to filing an appeal. Just as I noted, if we appeal the case and lose, the remedy for the defendant is that we're not allowed to go forward, the case is dismissed. And so we take it very seriously when we decide to appeal that. And it's not something that we take lightly. In fact, I know this is in the record before the court, but I think it's important to point out that at the 228 criminal cases decided by the First District Court of Appeals in 1996, only 8 were state appeals. Now, out of 156 appeals decided in the first half of 1997, only 2 were state appeals. So it's not something that we do often. Criminal quality of certification is not subject to review. Not only that, the Court of Appeals lacks the power statute, there's a constitutional provision, and there's no decision by this court that gives the appellate court the power to review a prosecutor's certification. So, that being the case, it's clearly erroneous for the Court of Appeals to review the prosecutor's certification in this case. We would ask this court to review reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and remand this case with instructions to proceed so that we can have this case decided on the merits.
Thank you, Mr. Rako. Mr. Ehrenstein.
May I please support Mr. Rako? I think that the basic issue in this case is whether or not this court wants to hand the keys to the state to the doors of the courts of appeals throughout the state. And I think what we have to decide here is whether or not we want non-critical issues, which this clearly was a non-critical issue, to ultimately be handed on the doorsteps of the courts of appeals.
What do you mean this was a non-critical issue? Motions to suppression of evidence are using crucial to cases. I don't understand.
I don't believe the refusal, whether or not a refusal is ultimately admissible, is critical under these circumstances. And I think that's particularly true in light of the recent case law, which says that the instruction that the jury is given with respect to the refusal is no longer what it used to be. Now it's simply the jury can take it for whatever value that they want to take it, whereas I think previously it was taken as some indicia or some admission on the part of the defendant that they were in fact under the influence. So now I think it's more ambiguous than it used to be, and the jury has the opportunity to determine.
Well, we have the right case law for the future, too. So let's take this a step further. Let's say that what was intended is the actual test. He agreed he took the test was suppressed.
Okay.
Now the same slur of speech, et cetera, et cetera. I sat through a bench trial once where the trial judge was a bench trial, and the attorney argued that the client was doing all of that slurring and stumbling around and everything like that because he had hit his head in the accident and had a head injury. And without the judge, there's been no real way to refute that. The judge wanted to let the guy off the hook. I mean, we have to design a test that would fit all circumstances. And how do you give this power to the Court of Appeals when they have none of the other evidence, none of the other witnesses, because they have no way of ascertaining the strength of the rest of the case, merely on an assertion in the trial?
It's not exactly correct. In fairness to Mr. Rako, he was not the prosecutor who handled the matter before the Court of Appeals. There was a transcript. There was a transcript of the motion to suppress.
Yeah, but your transcript only deals with the issues on the motion to suppress and not all the other evidence the prosecutor had.
That's not correct, though. Those issues deal with, number one, reasonable suspicion to stop. And you know that you're going to get a whole panoply of factual observations by the officer to determine whether initially there's a reasonable suspicion to stop. Then you're going to get into the field sobriety test, the observations of the officer with respect to the actual stop, and it is ultimately whether it flowers into probable cause or not. Then you still have the officer's observations in placing the individual under arrest, taking the individual back to the district, the interview with the individual. You have everything that you would normally have in a DUI case actually, I guess, foretold for trial purposes in the motion to suppress. So, in fact, the Court of Appeals had...
Well, that was a trial judge. I kept most of that stuff out because it wasn't relevant. It wasn't relevant to the actual issue of refusal to take the test. All that stuff that happened afterwards, I was...
Well, the issue of refusal is a very small component. Quite frankly, by my way of thinking, the issue of refusal is better because it shows that he or she is using their mental processes at the time that they are actually arrested. So when I try these cases, I try to turn it to show the jury that in fact my client is thinking clearly, does not wish to give them any more information, and simply politely refuses to submit to the test, which is what happened here to Bertrand Paul. I spoke with him and I advised him, I said, politely refuse to submit to the test, which is what he did. And I think that when the court has that transcript, I don't know how you ran your courtroom, but when we have, and you will see that this is a very extensive hearing in which a great many of the facts that would come out at trial actually did come out in the motion to suppress. The state, I think, would wish you to have a situation in which their 12J certifications are never subject to review. And I think that the courts of appeal clearly, under our Constitution, under Section 3, B2, Article 4, the courts of appeals have such jurisdiction as may be provided by law to review and affirm, modify or reverse judgments or final orders. And I think that has to be read in conjunction with Code 250502, which talks about what is in fact a final order and whether or not a final order affects a substantial right of the state.
But by choosing, the verb or the term certify or certification, that's an interesting choice of words. And is it a reasonable construction of the word, of the rule, having employed that word, the prosecutor shall certify, that that is enough to find that that's reviewable and final?
Justice Cook, the problem with that use of that word certify, and in the argument which the prosecutor raises, is that we have to assume, because of the rules that we as attorneys live under, that we are doing something because we truly believe it as it is. We are not doing something to obfuscate, delay, or to be unreasonable, or to hide a separate agenda, which maybe we have. Now, I'm not suggesting that these people have a separate agenda, but I think that that rule was created for those situations in which we do have individuals who have a separate agenda, where we have a situation where maybe a prosecution is politically motivated, we have a prosecution just because the individual is known in a community and they are going after that individual. And the problem that it is...
I'm not following, though. Are you addressing the use of the term certified? And we have to assume officers of the court.
Correct. That's what I'm saying.
Elected officials.
Correct.
And certified.
The problem with that is there is no apparatus for me to establish that they're acting in bad faith.
Right.
Okay, and the rule says that they should strictly comply. How do I challenge whether they have strictly complied other than, which I did at the time that I came in?
But there is a penalty for exercising it. Not for the bad faith scenario, but for exercising it ineptly.
The problem with that is it allows the state to micromanage a trial. And they may do that by raising what may be a meritorious claim, but which may ultimately be totally non-critical and have absolutely nothing to do with the ultimate resolution of the case.
And these are good arguments, but the General Assembly, this court and the General Assembly, enacted the rule despite those good arguments that you raised. I mean, is that...
Well, when they enacted the rule, what they did is they crossed over separation of powers. What they are doing is they are now giving the prosecution the authority to cross over into your province as judges, and they are now saying, if you take it to the next extreme, that you all have no authority to determine jurisdiction simply because they wish to appeal.
So we have prejudged it. I guess that's the point. We permitted it
in some cases and not permitted it in others. There are no cases which actually this court has spoken as to whether 12J certifications have to be taken at the court. The courts of appeals in the state are virtually split down the middle. We have three that follow Mr. Rakow's position and two which follow our position. But there is no actual ruling by this court which suggests that's the case. But this court has said repeatedly, and I don't know what the point would be to say repeatedly, they have to strictly comply with the rule. Well, strictly complying with the rule is just simply a veer that we believe this to be true. There is no way for us to ever challenge it.
But doesn't the prosecution have the inherent right to indict and prosecute or not to?
Yes, sir. Being led somewhere, yes, sir.
I mean, it's their determination whether they have sufficient evidence to indict and prosecute any certain individual, and we don't dispute that. Now, why shouldn't the prosecution be able to determine whether or not they may go forward with a trial if this certain portion of evidence is excluded? And in their determination, say, well, we can't go ahead without it. Why do we now say that the Court of Appeals should scrutinize this because in some way they're not being totally honest? What led the Court of Appeals to do this? Did you ask them to do this, to review the testimony?
What I did initially in the lower court is when I was told this was the case, I objected. And I was told that's their certification, so what people do. When I got to the Court of Appeals, I raised it as an issue in my brief. And when we appeared for oral argument, the judges felt that it should more properly have been filed a motion to dismiss. And they were troubled because their review of the transcript led them to believe that this was not critical evidence. So then we filed a motion to dismiss, which was ultimately, I think we argued it, and then it was granted. But to answer your question, I think clearly they have the threshold power to do what you suggest. But when we created 294567, the General Assembly created it, they did it because they recognized that there were certain circumstances in which the state should have the opportunity to appeal, just as the defendants have the opportunity to appeal. And what they did is when they then created Rule 12J and then ultimately amended it, they gave strict requirements that had to be met.
Look, now,
one of those requirements is that the state's case has to be...
But now you're not only making the court, the rule say that they have to make the statement that that is true, you're making them prove it.
I think that they should have to prove it.
Does the statute say that they have to prove it?
The purpose of the rule, and I think in the XREL Leeds versus Kraft, there are some considerations here. The first consideration is judicial economy. Okay, and I think that clearly judicial economy on a non-critical issue clearly weighs on behalf of the defendant in this particular case. The second is the fact that Mr. Bertram, a simple citizen, hires an attorney to represent him on a simple DUI. Now he finds himself 2 years down the line, still not having had his day in court. His attorney's fees going through the roof, certainly never having anticipated that this would be the case. And I think that these rules look toward that individual to make sure that there is a speedy dispatch of justice. And I think that what the Court of Appeals did here is they looked and they saw that this was a non-critical issue, that the speedy dispatch of justice and judicial economy...
You're going to, by getting us to say that the Court of Appeals has reviewing power to determine whether or not the prosecutor is lying, that's going to speed up the process?
I'm not saying that they have the opportunity to determine whether they're lying. I'm saying
determine
whether they are acting in bad faith or their certification is unreasonable.
Well, you're saying that the prosecution in its appeal is lying because they can go forward with other evidence and they don't need this. What other implication is there?
I didn't use the word lying.
Well,
what I'm saying is I think the problem with this is, Your Honor, is what may seem critical to a first-year attorney is certainly maybe not as critical to an experienced prosecutor or to an experienced defense attorney.
Doesn't the law let them determine that then?
I think the law allows them to attempt to determine that, but I think that the court should have ultimately the jurisdiction, which I think they are given by our Constitution, to make a decision as to whether or not this prosecutor is making an appropriate decision to certify an appeal. And I think that when they looked at this, they said, we think this is an innocent mistake on their part.
So now the Court of Appeals will have, of necessity, will have to determine every appeal taken, whether or not this is made in compliance with what they think the prosecutor can go ahead with the case or not. It really comes down to a determination by the Court of Appeals whether or not there is sufficient evidence to go ahead without this.
I think Mr. Rago's statistics show that this is a very atypical situation. And as the Court of Appeals noted, typically what you will see is in a drug case, all of the evidence literally torn from the case. And that is a typical situation. This is a very atypical situation. And that's what concerns me, and I think that's what concerns Justice Stratton, is the fact that we have to make a rule, and we have basically an atypical situation in which an extremely small, non-critical piece of evidence was not allowed in, and probably not correctly. But I don't think the trial judge made the correct decision because of the time ALS was due, and we really didn't know where that was going to go. But I think what we have here is a very insignificant piece of evidence which the state wants to bring in, which they don't need, which unfortunately I think will potentially change how 12J rules are handled. The only other thing I wish to say is, as I wish the court would heed the warning of Judge Mahoney in one of the decisions cited, which he is concerned, I think that we're all concerned, that we should not hand the keys to the prosecutors to the courts of appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ernstein. Mr. Rako, you save 5 minutes of your time.
I think Mr. Ernstein pointed out that the evidence in the case might have been significant from his point of view, and it also was insignificant, obviously, from the appellate court's point of view, but it was not insignificant from the prosecutor's point of view. And how we want to control the evidence in that case is strictly up to us. If we determine that this evidence is critical to our case and it was suppressed, we have the absolute right to appeal, certify that appeal, and the appellate court must entertain that appeal. If we lose, we know what the consequences are, so we're not going to take it lightly. The state's entitled to a fair trial, as is the defendant, and when we certify that criminal 12J, that's what we're trying to tell the court, hey, something happened here that's not fair, we want to review. I think there's no danger of the prosecutor making a false statement of law, and Judge George alluded in a concurring opinion in State versus White, I believe it is, that the 12J certification must be taken as true as an affidavit. And looking at the disciplinary rules, a lawyer is not going to make a false statement. No one would make a false statement of law or fact. We can also rely on that in this case as well. If this court decides to allow appellate courts to review certifications, what it's going to do is basically do away with the need for any 12J certification. It's going to do away with 2945.67, which gives the state the absolute right to appeal. It pushes to dismiss, pushes to suppress, pushes for return of property.
Wasn't that an overstatement, really? I mean, to say that if the Court of Appeals were to be able to review the certification doesn't take away the stature of the rule, does it? It just adds another step in the process. I mean, that's an overstatement, seems like, isn't it?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, what's going to happen is it's going to take away that appeal of right.
Why? Why?
Every state appeal into a discretionary appeal, because if they are allowed to review the certification, then they can choose which cases they want to hear and which cases they don't want to hear. And so we really, at that point...
You mean the Court of Appeals can determine which cases?
That's what's going to happen if they're allowed to review the certification. They're going to look at every single case, and they're going to say, well, we don't want to hear this one, we want to hear that one. They have enough evidence in this case, they don't have enough evidence in that case.
Or is it going to make the prosecution more attuned to their cases and not appeal cases in which they have other evidence?
I don't think so. I think it's a critical piece of evidence that the state feels that we want to...
I'm not saying in this case. I'm just saying if you can now certify anything without knowing the Court of Appeals is going to review it, then isn't that possibly open to abuse also?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and because the state must certify that this evidence is critical to the case, it puts us on the horns of a dilemma. If we appeal it and we lose the entire case. So it's not going to be taken lightly. And when the prosecutor certifies that appeal, the danger of the prosecutorial abuse is really very unassuring compared to the prosecutor who did that. Any case. So we ask this court to reverse and with the instructions to entertain the case on the merits.
Thank you, Mr. Rako. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.